Hello and welcome to Sowing the Seeds of Change, where we explore the ideas that are forming our future reality. My name is Dr. Rosalind Savage. After an environmental epiphany 20 years ago, I left a corporate career to row solo across three oceans, using my adventures to raise environmental awareness. And ever since then, I've been obsessed with how we create a better world. On this show, I talk with scientists, philosophers, economists, and activists about how we create a thriving world for people and planet.
You know, I love consequences. And I like a good consequence in a story. And there are consequences here. If you mess it up, the land becomes a wasteland. Or there is an inundation, a flood. You know, one or the other. The two happen, either wastelands or floods happen constantly in Celtic mythology as a response to humans messing up the balance between them and the natural world, and also disrespecting the other world. You know, and the other world in our tradition is not some transcendental kind of out there or up there place. It's not a place at all. It's entangled with this world. It kind of overlaps it and envelops it. It surrounds it. It's another layer, if you like, through which you can sometimes pierce the veil and see. And if you don't respect the other world, which in lots of ways is kind of similar to the very old concept of the anima mundi, the soul of the world, if you don't respect it, then again, bad stuff happens. And all of this stuff is presided over by women. The otherworldly women are the ones that understand when enough is enough, when too much has been taken, when that balance has been broken.
Dr. Sharon Blackie is an award-winning writer and internationally recognized teacher whose work sits at the interface of psychology, mythology, and ecology. She's probably best known as the best-selling author of If Women Rose Rooted, which weaves together Celtic mythology, interviews with some wonderful, powerful women, several of whom I know, and Sharon's personal story of her escape from the wasteland of so-called civilization into the wild and wonderful edges of Ireland and Scotland. She now lives in an old house which began life in the 1700s as a tiny nonconformist chapel on a small farm in the Cambrian Mountains in Wales. She and her husband live there with their hens, sheep, four border collies and Maeve, a tabby kitten, also known as the kitten of the apocalypse. Sadly, we didn't get around to discussing the kitten of the apocalypse in our conversation today, although the kitten did come up before we started recording, as she had just irreparably destroyed Sharon's headset. But we do talk about mythology, connection with land, talking to crows, the hero and heroine's journeys, the soul of the world, the importance of community, social media, the patriarchy, and Sharon's forthcoming book on the joys and the role of the older woman, Haggitude. Sharon Blackie, welcome to Sowing the Seeds of Change. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be part of it. It sounds like a wonderful series.
Yeah, thank you. We're actually relatively close to each other. I guess we'd be, what, 2 or 3 hours apart, but here we are on Zoom anyway.
Yeah, it's in the middle of the Cambrian Mountains in Wales. So, yeah, it's very beautiful. We live kind of up a hill and quite remotely. So it's a great place to spend some serious writing and thinking time.
Gorgeous, yeah. So I always kick off these conversations by asking my guest, what is their favourite quote and why? So would you be willing to please share with us your favourite quote?
Sure. Well, I have two favourite quotes from D.H. Lawrence, who had a huge impact on me when I first read The Rainbow at the age of 16, studying it for, I guess, A-level. And it was really hard to choose which one, but I'm gonna choose this one because I think it really relates to the kind of conversation we're probably going to have today. Oh, what a catastrophe. What a maiming of love. When it was made a personal, merely personal feeling, taken away from the rising and setting of the sun and cut off from the magic connection of the solstice and equinox. This is what is the matter with us. We are bleeding at the roots because we are cut off from the earth and sun and stars, and love is a grinning mockery because, poor blossom, We plucked it from its stem on the tree of life and expected it to keep on blooming in our civilized vase on the table.
I love the way that that ties together so many of the themes that I'd love to explore with you today. Like love and civilization and being cut off. Maybe I could ask you first, what does that quote mean to you? What is it in it that really resonates?
I think all of it, it just expresses so beautifully what we have lost as a species by sitting in our houses all the time, watching things move around on screens and miscellaneous contraptions that we own, and so rarely going outside and actually communicating with what matters, which is the earth and the other than humans that share it with us. So it's a typical Lawrence passionate statement about, you know, what he perceived to be the rise of the machine and the loss of our connection with something that's much more meaningful.
Absolutely. And just out of curiosity, and without wanting you to quote the whole of the other one, but what is the other D.H. Lawrence quote that you love so much?
Well, I don't have it here and I can't remember all of it, but it's about the cool underlying life. And it's something like, when we get out of the glass cages of our egos, something like cool undying life will come in. It's just like, that's just amazing. The glass cages of our egos. You know, he had his flaws as a man, undoubtedly, but as a writer and as a visionary, I think he really got to the heart of a lot of what was lacking in humans at his time and still today.
Even back then, yeah. I thought you would say that one. And I actually, when I read that in your book, I was blown away by it. I loved it so much that I borrowed it from you as the opening to the conclusion of my doctoral dissertation. So thank you very much for introducing me to that quote.
That's great.
I love them both. So that actually ties in with one of my favourite quotes, which is from your book, If Women Rose Rooted, this quote about the wasteland. We're caught not only in an industrial wasteland, but in a wasteland of the heart and the spirit. The wasteland is not just outside of us, a sickness in the system, in our culture. The wasteland is in ourselves. The heroine's journey for these times is a journey out of the wasteland. And this is actually something you and I have in common. We've both worked in that wasteland and found it lacking. So maybe you could just share a little bit about your heroine's journey from the wasteland into somewhere more beautiful.
Well, really, I think even as a small child, I had a very clear sense that I had something to do in this life. I know that sounds weird, that this was not a free ride, you know, that I had some particular gift or something to share. I don't mean anything grandiose, you know, that I had to do anything grandiose, but I was here to be or to do something. And when I chose safety over that sense of calling, I guess, having grown up in a fairly impoverished situation with all kinds of complications in my childhood, I wanted something safe. I wanted a job. I wanted to earn money. I wanted, you know, not to live in poverty anymore. And so I chose a corporate existence for quite some time, but all the way through it, I knew that this was not where I was supposed to be. And it got to a stage where in my early 30s, it really started to show. I started to have little panic attacks. I would sit in the car every morning, just not wanting to get out of it and go into that building. And it took me a long while and a couple of twists and turns to completely break free of it, which I guess I didn't really do until I was getting on for 40. And to me, it all began, that recovery, I guess, from the wasteland really began when I moved from America, where I was living at the time, to a croft on the northwest, in the northwest highlands of Scotland, and really began to think very carefully about my roots, both in the land and in the myths and stories of the land, you know, our kind of our inheritance, if you like, our tradition, our folk and mythical tradition. And that really revolutionized everything about me. It opened up all kinds of new possibilities, writing, teaching. All of the work that I do now was founded on that experience of going back to the land and really learning how to belong to it. And so when I spoke in If Women Rose Rooted about the heroine's journey, I also called it the eco-heroine's journey, because to me it was very much a journey back to that sense of belonging to the land, to the earth, and finding the roots that Lawrence, you know, so rightly pointed out that we had lost.
And You were living on the Isle of Lewis at that time, and probably not very many of our listeners have been there. Am I right in saying that it was the Isle of Lewis?
I was on in a croft in just outside of Ullapool for 7 years before I met my husband and we got married, and then we had a joint midlife crisis. It was about my third by then, and we moved to the Isle of Lewis after that. Yeah, to another croft.
Yeah, you can't really imagine anywhere, whether it's Ullapool or the Isle of Lewis, anywhere more different from an urban centre. I mean, it's bleak, it's windy, there is weather. And in the winter, there is not a lot of daylight. And so it seems like the sort of place where most mortals would really want to huddle inside rather than getting out there and really connecting with the land. There was a certain courage in you in engaging with that rawness. But do you feel like the elemental nature of the far north of Scotland was maybe essential to that sort of rehabilitation and healing that you went through?
Yes, it was. I mean, I think it was nice. It was quite nice in the croft outside Ullapool because it wasn't quite so wild. I mean, it was, you know, northwest of Highland, so it was wild enough. But it was kind of gentle compared to the Isle of Lewis. When we went to the Isle of Lewis, we had a, as I said, a joint midlife crisis where it had finally hit us what was happening to the world. You know, in our early 40s, it took long enough, I guess. But we had figured out that we were, you know, as humans and as a planet, we were not going to get out of this mess very easily. And so we decided we wanted to get as far away from civilization as we possibly could. So we ended up in the most remote part of the Isle of Lewis. You know, we could see St Kilda from our kitchen window on a very good day. And it was that extremity. We had a croft, we had animals, we had cows, we had sheep, we had pigs, we had turkeys at one point, ducks, geese, hens, you know, there was no option but to be outside. And also we had dogs, working sheep dogs that needed to be walked. Every morning, as early as it was possible to, I would be walking that land with the dogs. And there were no people to talk to. So I talked to the land and just completely immersed myself in all that weather. And that really was a radical way of connecting, of actually making a proper relationship with the land. Because I was talking to the land, to rocks, to all, you know, all types of all of the things that were in the landscape, living or rock-like. I was talking to them as if they were people, as if they were my friends, because there was nobody else there to do that. And, you know, to me, that is how you really, really build a sense of relationship and belonging to a place. It worked, yeah.
One of the books that I've got here on top of my writing bureau is The Garden Awakening by Mary Reynolds. And early on in that book, she talks about walking around your garden and feeling it, like feeling what is the emotional vibration of this land? What is it crying out for? Is it asking for healing? Has it been abused? And I suppose too often in our so-called civilized world, we think of the earth beneath our feet as just being a lump. whether we think of it as soil or dirt or rock, we don't think of it as a living being with its own vibration. So was that revelation to you to find that you had this relationship with the ground under our feet?
It was an utter revelation. And a lot of it also came through story. You know, I've worked with story for a very long time prior to moving to Lewis as a psychologist, working with narrative, a form of narrative psychology that I specialised in. But in that part of the world, the stories were, the myths, the folklore were very much attached to places, you know, to specific places. So there's this wonderful character in Gaelic mythology, Irish Manx and Scottish, called the Cailleach, literally the old woman. And she's the old woman in our mythology who creates and shapes the land. It wasn't some old bloke in a sky. It was an old woman who kind of personified the land. And, you know, there are mountains named after her. There are villages named after her. There are Cailleach place names everywhere in that part of the world. And a lot of them are attached to reclining, what look like reclining figures, you know, silhouettes of reclining women in the landscape. So you look at a hill and the shape of the hill looks like a reclining figure. There are lots of those, surprisingly, around in Scotland and Ireland. And a lot of them are named after the Cailleach. And we had one outside our house. You looked out and it was the figure of a reclining woman. So I talked to it and I learned, you know, she was the Kalyuk to me. I learned about that folklore and it was a real sense of developing a relationship, not just with rocks and crows in the sense that you know that they're physical animals, you know their ecology, you know what they sound like, you know where they build their nests and so on. But with this extra kind of mythic overlay on a rock or on a crow, which gives you a sense of depth, if that makes sense, and a real kind of spiritual connection rather than just a sense of knowledge of the land, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that fascinates me about these Celtic powerful females is that it feels like in fairy tales, for example, often the female characters are kind of rather weak and needy and waiting for their prince to come and rescue them or wake them from a deep sleep or whatever. Whereas it feels like these much older mythologies, there's that real feminine power that somehow got lost or suppressed along the way. You know, as we're both corporate refugees, I'll maybe compare and contrast that with the sort of female leadership that I tended to see when I was working in my part of the wasteland, that often the female leadership looked quite masculine. And I'm wondering what we can learn from these ancient mythological women about what powerful feminine leadership looks like for the 21st century.
Yes, I agree with you. I think, you know, most women these days are taught to take a hero's journey in the sense that Joseph Campbell talked about it. You know, we're not really taught to think of what our own journey would look like. And I think it is very different because the classic hero's journey is very active. It's outward looking. It's a little bit linear. You know, you have a task to do and you go and do it and then you come back and you save the world with, you know, with whatever you've brought back from the journey. And, you know, I don't think women really look at it like that. I think it's much more about depth, about connection, about relationship building. And one of the phrases that I've used since If Women Rose Rooted to try and encompass the possibility of a change in the way we approach the journey for both men and women is the post-heroic journey. You know, what does a post-heroic journey look like in a post-heroic world? And the old stories teach us a lot about that too, because a lot of those old stories are about living in balance and harmony and not taking too much. You know, there's this great old Irish tale, which I think is pretty much everywhere in the British Isles as well, called about a cow called the Glass Gavelin, basically the cow of plenty. And it's this wonderful old story, which many people listening might well recognise, where basically the cow gives milk to everybody as much as they need it. And she'll allow everybody to take a pail of milk to feed themselves. And then one day somebody comes along with a sieve and milks the cow through a sieve into pail after pail after pail. And because it's a sieve, of course, she doesn't know that the pail is full. And once she realizes that they're taking more than their fair share, off she goes, buggers off. That's the last you see of the cow of plenty. And, you know, so these old stories, that's just one example, or many of them. These old stories are there to teach us about balance and living in harmony. And that, to me, is the essence of what the old stories in our tradition of these islands tell us, that women represented the moral authority of the other world. They understood what was necessary and what was right and what was true. And they represented the balance, if you like, of the earth. So you have the Kalyuk. In Scotland, you have wonderful stories of the Kalyuk forbidding hunters from taking female deer in season, you know, when they're pregnant, and saying, okay, I'll give you a stag if you will leave my hinds alone. So this sense that they are literally guardians and protectors of the land and of and forbidding humans to take too much, to go too far. That is what I think the women in our old stories teach us more than anything, that we know, you know, we have a sense of it because we are very embodied creatures, women, by nature of, you know, all of the things that we're able to do, from giving birth through to all kinds of other biological phenomena. And I think that's the nature of our female wisdom.
And I want to come back to the embodiment part later, but just as you were saying that, it was making me think about The first time I went to South America, I was really struck by the contrast between Mother Nature, who has, in my mind anyway, generally been portrayed as endlessly giving and generous, and maybe even a little bit sort of saccharine, compared with the South American Pachamama, who seemed to have a much stronger sense of her own, maybe sovereignty would be the right word, that if you disrespected her, then she would let you know that she was displeased. And that was quite mind-blowing for me. And that seems maybe a little bit closer to the Kalyakh.
Yeah, to the whole concept, not just the Kalyakh, but all of the, or really throughout Celtic mythology, legends, folklore, you have this sense that if you mess it up, there'll be consequences. You know, I love consequences. And I like a good consequence in a story. And there are consequences here. If you mess it up, the land becomes a wasteland, or there is an inundation, a flood. You know, one or the other. The two happen. Either wastelands or floods happen constantly in Celtic mythology as a response to humans messing up the balance between them and the natural world, and also disrespecting the other world. You know, and the other world in our tradition is not some transcendental kind of out there or up there place. It's not a place at all. It's entangled with this world. It kind of overlaps it and envelops it. It surrounds it. It's another layer, if you like, through which you can sometimes pierce the veil and see. And if you don't respect the other world, which in lots of ways is kind of similar to the very old concept of the anima mundi, the soul of the world, if you don't respect it, then again, bad stuff happens. And all of this stuff is presided over by women. The otherworldly women are the ones that understand when enough is enough, when too much has been taken, when that balance has been broken.
It does sometimes feel like organized religion abstracted the consequences into the next lifetime, rather than them being much more immediate. And the old mythologies, it's the consequence is much more present. I feel like there's also this theme of love wanting to emerge here, which picks up on that from the quote that you read at the start, that it feels like an important aspect of this feminine leadership that's needed right now, that maybe to some extent differentiates the hero's journey from the heroine's journey, although I think there is love of a different kind embodied in the hero's journey. But there's this real love in the sense of deep connection, of oneness with, that is what the earth is needing right now. But I'm also curious about how feminine leadership now can really embody that love in a way that feels strong rather than soft. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I think it comes down to fierceness. You know, particularly if you look at a lot of the old women in, not just in Celtic folklore, but throughout Europe and into the Slavic tradition, they are very fierce, but it is a loving fierceness. They're fierce because they will not let what they love be destroyed. You know, they won't allow the predation. And so they stand up and they say no more. Now, they don't ever destroy in the proper old stories. They don't ever destroy for the sake of destroying. You know, they're not lashing out in anger when there are consequences for not caring enough about the world and its inhabitants. But we have this concept of love, I think, which, and I don't know whether it's grown out of some kind of misalignment with the Christian tradition, or whether it's just a function of the patriarchy in some other sense. We have this sense of love as saccharine, you know, love as being all light and fluffy and pink and pretty. And it's not in the old tradition. Love is fierce. You know, love is protective. And I think that's okay. And at a time, just as any mother, I think, would feel very protective towards her child if it were threatened, and be fairly fierce, I suspect, in holding fast there, that is the kind of love I think that we have for the earth. Because if we just sit back and love it and say, oh, isn't it pretty, you know, no dear, you mustn't, you know, if you're going to predate it, don't be a naughty person, you know, just the idea that we can love people into not committing atrocities is crazy. It's that fierce love that we see time and time again in our old stories.
It's making me think. I read that the line in Genesis that is usually translated as giving man dominion over the earth was actually meant to be stewardship of the earth, which feels much more like that fierce protective love than dominion over, which sounds a lot more like domination.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And that's really very much what we're talking about. You know, you're seeing these very fierce women in the old stories as stewards, indeed, of the land and protectors of the other creatures that inhabit it alongside us, so that we don't take more than our fair share. I mean, if you look back at even at Greek mythology and the Fates, you know, the three Fates who were old women in the texts, maybe not in the pretty artwork that came from it, but certainly in the texts. And Fate was all about keeping balance. You know, the Fates stepped in when somebody took more than their share of the plunder of war, or more than their share of something, you know, a lot more profound. So this is all what it's about. You know, it's a bit of tough love, but it is love. It comes out of a love for the world and an unwillingness to see it break.
Sowing the Seeds of Change is brought to you through the generous support of Seeds, now growing together in a bioregion near you. Seeds is an experimental global collaborative community, learning how to collectively govern and regenerate our one home, this earth, one village at a time. Learn more at joinseeds.earth. So Sharon, I'm going to ask you one of my usual questions now. If you were democratically elected Queen of the world for a day, what would your first decree be and why?
I'd have lots of decrees, so this wouldn't be my only one. But at the moment, I can say categorically, my first one would be to take down Twitter and probably a lot of other social media. I think that is doing so much damage in terms of the quality of the discourse, but there is no discourse really on Twitter. It's a little bit of a mob rule. And I think that kind of situation where everybody is shouting at each other and trying to undermine each other is exactly what we don't need in a very, very challenged world. I think it takes our attention away from the source of the real problem. So yeah, I'd have a bit of a thing about social media, I think, if I could.
And is there something that you would like to see happen instead of social media, a different kind of communication that you might issue a decree in favour of?
I think, do you know what I would really recommend, just for a little while anyway, is I'd require, if I had that power, I'd require everybody to actually remember how to communicate and how to make relationships with the people around them, with actual real physical people in their communities. And I think we often lose sight of that. Wonderful as social media can be, and I have benefited from it too when I've lived in very remote places, but it distracts us from building relationships with real live people who impact or should impact our daily lives. And that's a great pity.
And it's been interesting. So at the time we're recording this, here in the UK, we're in a time of lighter lockdown. But during COVID, communication and that kinship has become so mediated through technology, hasn't it? So yeah, maybe mandatory campfires, or in the winter, gathering around the hearth, given the English and Welsh climates, for a while, so we can get used to direct person-to-person communication again.
Indeed, let's bring back the Kaylee. Turn off the telly and bring back the Kaylee. That would be my prescription for a happier world.
Indeed. And because we have quite a lot of American listeners, do you just want to say a bit about what the Kaylee is, in case anybody's not familiar with that?
Oh, the Kaylee would have been, it's an Irish word, and it would have referred to in the winter half of the year, when the nights were dark and there was little to do on the land and with the animals, then people would gather in a house. All of the community would gather together in a house, and they'd tell stories and sing songs and tell jokes and what have you. That's your Kaylee.
And I imagine that's how a lot of those ancient myths were passed along, would be at Kaylee's and people getting together and telling the old stories.
Indeed. And in our tradition, what's interesting is that the men and the women told quite different stories. So the men would tend to go, in the Gaelic and Gaelic traditions, the men would tend to do the hero tales, you know, the great sagas, Cuchulain and Finn and all of those guys and their grand adventures and exploits. Whereas it was women who tended to tell what we would now call folk tales or fairy tales, these kind of wisdom tales, if you like, about not taking too much and the like. So that's always interested me, that there was this split in what was perceived to be the terrain of men and women.
But presumably, no matter who the storyteller was, the audience would still be mixed so that everybody got the stories from both sides?
Not always. Sometimes, yes, but there was also in many places a tradition of female-only gatherings and male-only gatherings.
And there is a time and a place and a space for that as well still, I think. I have to confess, and I'm a little ashamed of this, that as a Brit, I was very, like, utterly unfamiliar with most of our traditional stories until I read If Women Rose Rooted. And I'm so grateful to you for introducing those stories to me. I was probably more familiar with the myths of other cultures than of my own. Do you feel that it's important we connect with the stories from our own ancient culture?
I find it very sad when people are constantly looking to the east or further west, even to the very beautiful Native American tradition, for stories of living in balance and harmony with the earth when we've got them here. And it's not just that we've got them here, it's that they are tied to our land and to our places. They're in this country. They're part of our lineage. And I think that if we don't have a sense that we too have that tradition, we too have a whole lineage of stories about living in balance and harmony with the earth and all kinds of other good stuff, then we never really feel ownership, you know, of the problem that we've created. And I think it really, my experience since I wrote If Women Rose Rooted and produced workshops and courses and so on around these ideas of belonging to place, particularly through story, it does seem to be remarkably empowering for people to realise that this is our lineage too, you know, because we hear so many bad things about the West and what we have inflicted upon the world. And of course we have. But before that happened, we had some really good stuff. And it's not all that long ago. And I don't see why we can't reclaim those stories and reclaim some of the wisdom, and particularly the women's wisdom, that is so lost from the world, that we will find in those stories. So yeah, I think it is absolutely critical. And when I was a kid, I read fairy stories and myths all the time. But these stories were presented to me really as kind of entertainment. You know, they were never presented as cosmologies, and they were evidence of cosmology. They weren't just entertaining stories. The women in these old stories, once upon a time, were our deities. They were the ones who were honoured in the same way that we would honour other gods now. And that's really important to understand. And it's a big leap, I think, as you say, for a lot of people. But once you've made that leap, it's just like, wow, it's amazing. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful mythology that we have.
It really is. And when I read If Women Rose Rooted, the place where I was living was close to a well. It was actually where there was a natural spring that had been directed into a font type structure. And you could see the water actually bubbling up there. And often as I walked past that, I would think of the story of the maidens of the wells, which was such a heart-rending story. And I'm going to sort of put you on the spot now and ask if you could share a sort of shortened version of that story with our listeners.
Sure. It's a story that appears in French romance writer Chrétien de Troyes' Percival, which is a story about the search for the Grail. But it, to cut a long story short, it has been traced back to Wales and possibly has even older Irish influences as well. And it tells of the Holy Wells, basically, in the Kingdom of Logres, which would have been most of the west of England, Cornwall and a bit of Wales at the time. And there was a network of wells which were conduits to the other world. All wells in the old tradition were conduits to the other world. And they were inhabited by otherworldly women, the well maidens, who would come out of the well if a traveller should happen by who was hungry and thirsty. And they would offer the traveller whatever food he might require from their golden platters and a drink of well water, this wonderful nourishing well water from their golden grails, and it was all very well until one day a king came along who didn't respect that bargain that, you know, people had with the other world in the form of the well maidens who would give their nourishment in return for respect. He didn't respect that, and one day he came upon a well maiden and he took the food and he took the water and then he raped her while his men looked on. And seeing what the king had done, the men went off all over the rest of the country and raped all of the well maidens. And so, not surprisingly, they didn't come out of the wells anymore. And the story says that the voices of the wells were lost. And as a consequence, because that nourishing, life-giving in every sense, water no longer came from the wells, the land became a wasteland. So that was, to me, it's one of the foundational stories. You know, you don't see many stories like that in any tradition. And the idea that we don't know that story anymore, that we've forgotten that story, you know, it's the disrespecting of women, it's the disrespecting of the other world and the kind of spiritual influence and the disrespecting of the land itself and real consequences.
It's such a heartbreaking story. And when I first read it, I just remember sort of feeling gut punched by it. And I don't think that's just as a woman. It was just so shocking. And the scale of the loss that resulted from that act was so overwhelming, just seemed really tragic. And that actually leads into a quote that I have in my notes here from If Women Rose Rooted. The same kinds of acts that are perpetrated against us as women, against our daughters and our mothers, are perpetrated against the planet. The earth which gives us life, the earth with which women have for so long been identified, our patriarchal, warmongering, growth and domination-based culture has caused runaway climate change, the mass extinction of species, and the ongoing destruction of wild and natural landscapes in the unstoppable pursuit of progress. So true. So how can we, either through reconnecting with the land or reconnecting with these stories or maybe even creating new stories for ourselves, how can we help ourselves out of this dominator paradigm and into one that's based on partnership and harmony with nature?
Yeah, it's an easy question, isn't it? We'll do that in 2 minutes. I guess there are many ways to change the world, aren't there? There are people who go out there and who are activists and the very wonderful Extinction Rebellion and so on, who come at this from a very necessary level, political change or social and cultural change at that level. I was trained and still see myself as a psychologist. And so to me, that's no good. That kind of action is useless if you can't change the way that people perceive the world and their relationship with it. So you need both. So you need this kind of top-down approach, perhaps. And what I'm looking at, what I'm interested in, is the bottom-up approach. How do we transform people's way of seeing themselves in relationship to the world? And of course, we still have, and it's just built into the cultural mythology, we still have this idea that the world is there as a backdrop for human activity and that we have a right to take everything that we want from it and never mind what's left for anybody else. I have seen people change dramatically simply by the kinds of acts that I'm talking about, you know, of going out and talking to the world as if it were real, as if it were animate, as if it were a being like you that had some stake in this planet. And just a simple act like that of walking outside your house, turning the screens off, walking outside, talking to a crow, talking to a tree, just addressing it like you would address a neighbor in the street, makes all of the difference. It undermines that separation that we have fallen into, and it makes you see yourself as a part of everything else around you rather than something that is standing above it. So I think that really we change that, from my perspective, by transforming our relationship with the land and the world around us, whether we live in the middle of a city or whether we live in the wilds. Just that sense of belonging, of relationship. And again, if you look back at the old Celtic stories, for example, Animal wisdom was valued as much as human wisdom. So you had old goddesses, like if in the Irish tradition, the Morrigan, who was a crow goddess, who's often called a goddess of war. She wasn't. It was much more interesting than that. She was a goddess of life and death. But she happened to show herself very often in human form and very often in crow form. And there was no, the human form wasn't better. It was just different. And this whole idea that animals have a wisdom, have ways of being in the world that we need to understand and to respect is intrinsic to that mythology. You have these wonderful old stories in the Welsh tradition where, you know, they'll go off looking for the answer to a question and they'll go to the elders of a particular village and they don't know. So they send them to the elders of another village and they don't know. So they say, go to the animals. And then they end up going to the oldest animals, and it's the oldest animals who know the answer to the question. So I think the stories have a lot to teach us. And I talk to crows all the time, particularly. I have a real thing for crows. I'm always talking to crows. And that just makes me think that crows are as valuable as I am, because I talk to them like I would talk to my friends or my family or my neighbours when I'm walking outside. So really, it sounds very simple. But as I say, I've seen it really profoundly shift people's perspective on their place in the world just by doing that kind of thing.
And picking up on that place in the world idea, it often feels like we're being asked to rebuild our relationship with the natural world for the benefit of the natural world, rather than to rebuild the relationship because we are part of the natural world and it actually benefits us. It makes our lives better. It restores us to our place here rather than being separate from it all. And in The Enchanted Life, you talk about this disenchantment and the re-enchantment, and it somehow feels that these are connected, that as we have disconnected from the natural world, we've become disenchanted at the same time as we have taken the enchantment out of our understanding of nature. And that when we re-enchant everything, we re-enchant ourselves between humans and the other parts of the natural world is something that our cultural narrative has lost. And when we actually nurture that and recreate that and heal that, then there is something tremendously beautiful and healing about that. So yes, we do need to regenerate the earth, but it feels like there's also something there about the regeneration of the human heart.
Yes, I think you're quite right. They're absolutely entangled. The two things are entwined. And I don't mean to sound anthropocentric when I say that I think the earth benefits from good humans, just as we benefit from the earth. And again, you know, there is again that old tradition, Greek, Sufi, everywhere, the other world in the Celtic tradition, which teaches us way, way back that there is a soul in everything, that everything is ensouled, I suppose is the way of putting it. The anima mundi, the soul of the world, imbues everything, whether it's a rock or a crow or a human being. And I always feel that in disconnecting ourselves from the world and just, you know, sitting here glaring at our screens and our gadgets, we run the risk of that soul kind of dying. Fading, I suppose, for lack of attention. So I think that by going out there and talking to crows and remembering the stories that are in the land, we are also in a very, very real way keeping that soul of the world alive. And in keeping it alive, yes, we are absolutely keeping ourselves alive because it's all entangled. We can separate ourselves in our heads, perhaps intellectually, in our imaginations, but we're not separate, and we fade just as the world fades if we don't keep in relationship with it.
That's reminding me of a program, I think it was with Greg Braden, that was talking about entanglement in the quantum sense and taking it all the way back to the Big Bang when the whole universe was compressed in such a tiny little lump and expanding from the Big Bang to say that actually everything in the universe could be entangled in the physical quantum physics sense, not just in a fluffy spiritual sense, but in a very real sense that we just can't yet explain.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are many examples, aren't there, of situations where old folktales, old myths have this idea of entanglement. Indra's web in there in the Indian tradition, the web that was woven by the Fates or in the Greek tradition, or the Norns in the Scandinavian tradition. All of these ideas of interconnection of different nodes linked to each other in the mythical sense now seem increasingly to be reflected in the world of hard science and physics. So yeah, that's interesting stuff.
Sowing the Seeds of Change is brought to you through the generous support of Seeds, now growing together in a bioregion near you. Seeds is an experimental global collaborative community, learning how to collectively govern and regenerate our one home, this earth, one village at a time. Learn more at joinseeds.earth. Welcome back. And Sharon, I would like to ask you, in these strange times that we're in, I'm wondering, when was the last time that you did something for the first time, and what was it?
Well, I don't want to sound snippy when I say this, but I'm 60. I just turned 60 a couple of weeks ago. And
happy birthday.
Thank you. And I think as I've grown older, it's become much less important to me to do things for the first time. You know, it's very much been, and that's not an active choice, but it's very much been about deepening the things that matter to me. So going deeper into writing, going deeper into some of the ideas and deeper into teaching. And so I'd have to say it's probably a very long time ago that I actively remember doing something for the first time, you know, and thinking of it in that way. And yet, in trying to give you an answer that was not seemingly snippy, I thought to myself, well, what really have I done recently for the first time? And the truth is, chemotherapy, almost die, I suppose. I was diagnosed earlier this year with lymphoma and had to undergo quite a serious treatment for it, which happily looks as if it's been successful. But that looking death in the face in that way, probably hadn't done before. So that's a first, that kind of illness. And that, I'm afraid, is probably the best that I can do.
That's a pretty stunning answer. And I'm very happy to hear that the treatment has gone well. I also hope that is the last time that you have to go through that.
Me too.
How do you feel that has changed you? And I wonder if that's also connected with your next book, which I believe is going to be called Haggitude. And as someone rapidly approaching haghood myself, if I'm not already there, I'm curious about this and whether clearly hag implies a certain stage of life where maybe our mortality starts to loom larger on the horizon than it has so far. So can you tell us a little bit about your work in progress, please?
Yeah, well, Haggitude actually began about two and a half years ago, and it should have been written finished quite a long time ago. But in the meantime, we did a major international relocation, navigated a global pandemic. I had a bout of rheumatoid arthritis, and then I got lymphoma. So it's like the world kind of intervened, and it was a very, very funny thing in lots of ways, because here I was at the age of, 57 then, thinking, I'm going to write a book about elderhood. And it was as if the universe took me by the scruff of the neck and said, you want to write about elderhood? We'll show you elderhood. Have some of this. I handed the manuscript over to my editor just yesterday afternoon. So it is actually pretty much done, and will be published next autumn. And it is very much about these very fierce old women of European mythology who tend to run the show, you know, behind the scenes a little bit in the stories. They're really the protagonist of the stories, but they are the ones who are keeping the action moving. They're the ones who mentor the heroes and heroines, the younger heroes and heroines. They're the ones who test them. They're the ones who guard and protect the earth, like the Kalia. They're the ones who weave the web of the world, like the Fates and the Norns that we've already spoken about. And so it was looking at the way that old women today, older women, not just old women, are really trivialized at best. We're required to be invisible. We're not supposed to have a voice. We're supposed to go away quietly and die. And all of these older stories show us a very, very different world in which older women were profoundly respected and had a particular kind of wisdom. So I wanted to really begin with those stories and to see what Those stories told us about the various ways in which we could grow into a more meaningful elderhood and a more contributory elderhood. And yes, death is very much a part of that, but it's a book that begins with menopause, because it seems to me that menopause as a transition for women is really the beginning of elderhood. You know, that's when so many of the things that we've become accustomed to during our adult life, our more active adult life, begin to fade away. And of course, a lot of people see that as having things taken away from us because we're menopausal, whereas I really genuinely do see it as a wonderful opportunity to focus on different things. And so, yes, it's a journey inevitably that ends with death, and I have inevitably drawn on my own experience of befriending death, I suppose, and walking hand in hand with death for a little while in talking about the later stages of elderhood. But, you know, now that we're living longer in the West, we often have many decades of what we might think of as elderhood in which to do meaningful and useful work.
Absolutely. And there are some phenomenal role models out there of women, even into their 80s, who are still so active. I'm thinking of some particular figures in the consciousness and environmental movements like Rianne Eisler and Barbara Marx Hubbard and Sylvia Earle, and these absolute forces of nature who are certainly not spent by the time they get to menopause. They're really just hitting their stride by then. And it's really wonderful to be inspired by them. And of course, my perspective might be biased. I'm 53 now, and a lot of my friends are in their 50s and 60s, but I'm really feeling like this is where it's happening.
Yeah, I think there are signs of that. And the trick is really, you know, in the wider culture to find opportunities for older women to continue having voices. But again, you know, when you read the newspapers, or when you watch television, you look at the media in general, that process of aging is presented as just about decline. You know, so we hear a lot about old people's homes and how terrible they are. We hear a lot about Alzheimer's disease. We don't hear very much about the opportunities that older people have to make a genuine contribution in the way that we would do if we were in other indigenous societies around the world, you know. So I think it's partly about, again, inspiring older women with the power of these old stories to see that there are so many different ways of being a good elder. You know, there's not just one. It's not just about the ones who speak out. There are all kinds of very quiet ways as well in those old stories, but they are essential. And again, it comes back to what I guess I was beginning with, if women are as rooted in trying to redress the balance of the lost voices of the feminine in this world.
And you so often make the point that the stories that we tell ourselves are so important. And so, yes, if we're constantly exposed to stories about old age being about decrepitude and obsolescence, then it becomes a bit self-fulfilling. So I'm delighted to hear about Haggitude, and I'm really looking forward to reading it. And I wonder if we can just, before we turn the tables, end on a sort of practical note, because you do talk a lot about this embodied sense of belonging to the earth. And having grown up in a very cerebral brain oriented, even left brain oriented kind of a family, country and culture, I often struggle to really feel things in an embodied way. And I wonder if you could share with us a practice that shows how you develop that really embodied connection with the place where you live.
Well, I think I've answered half of that earlier by stressing this need to go out and talk to things, to go out and engage with things and to stroke things. You know, it's not just about talking or singing or whatever you might want to do to a crow. It's about touching a tree. So if I walk down the lane, you know, I'm constantly putting my hand out to a plant or to a tree. It just builds up that sense of a very physical connection. And the other thing that worked for me, and I don't know whether this is feasible for everybody, but it was really to be outside in that crazy old weather that we got up in the northwest of Scotland and in the islands. And of course, we get plenty of weather around the British Isles in general. We don't have to go very far. And in America and wherever your readers are. And I think we also have a tendency to protect ourselves a little bit too much from that. Again, unless we have to be out for because that's our job. And really, when I went to the Western Isles, I didn't like wind. I thought wind was just, I didn't see the point of it. It was offensive. I didn't want to be blown about and my hair messed and all of that kind of thing. But when you live in a place where wind is the texture of your life, you know, where I don't remember wind-free days in the Western Isles, then that consciously building relationship and connection, constantly, consciously courting the weather, standing out in the wind and beginning to see the wind actually is actually rather playful, you know, and beginning to think of the different characteristics of an easterly wind, which is very fretty, kind of picking at you kind of wind, you know, it's very turbulent, it's a strange kind of wind. And then the force of the western wind, which is very much fiercer, very much about sheer brute strength, at least in that part of the world. And just beginning to focus on how the wind played with your hair, how it lifted your hair, just that sense of being in the weather. And the same with rain, you know, the same with wet stuff, which we tend to kind of, you know, put raincoats on and umbrellas and all that malarkey. And really just feeling the different kinds of rain at the different times of year was a really grounding thing for me. So I guess apart from the talking to crows and the stroking trees and what have you, I'd say really go and build a relationship with weather, because we tend to see it as separate from the land, you know? And of course, the weather has created the land and shaped the land. It's the wind and rain that make our country what it is. And I don't think we really focus on that enough.
So it's not just us touching the elements of nature, it's allowing the elements of nature to touch us as well through the wind and the rain. And I feel like it's no coincidence that my friend Ian McGilchrist, who thinks a lot about this holistic, interconnected perspective of the world, he has chosen to live on the west coast of the Isle of Skye because he loves the edgeness of it. And that's something that you write about a lot too, is living life on the edges in the liminal spaces where the water meets the land. And it feels like there's a metaphor there for the edginess of the time that we're living in, when we feel on the edge of disaster, maybe the edge of a breakthrough, that being in these liminal spaces maybe liberates the thinking and shakes us up a bit.
Yeah, and of course, in the old traditions, in the Celtic traditions and the other old British traditions, the liminal zones, the edge spaces, were where the veil was thin between this world and the other world. You know, there's this lovely notion of the black shore, for example, on the seashore, the black shore being where the seaweed washes up and it's black. That's kind of the tidal zone, I suppose, where tides shift. Those were places where you could more easily slip into the other world or have another worldly encounter. And so I think also they connect us in a deeper way to whatever we perceive the other world, the world soul, to be as well.
Thank you so much for all of your insights and your wisdom. So it's time to turn the tables. Is there anything that you'd like to ask me, although you're a tough act to follow?
No, I definitely want to ask you. You're a much tougher act to follow in lots of ways, talking about physical stuff and embodiment. But given that I am so very much focused on story and the stories that shape us, I'd love to know whether there was a book that you read as a child which you can look back on and say, that helped make me who I am today.
So the reason I'm laughing is that you've already described how D.H. Lawrence had such a deep impact on you. I'm afraid that my answer is so much more trivial than that. I used to just love the Enid Blyton books, which were a very different kind of literature, shall we say, from D.H. Lawrence. And I'm talking about at a younger age. This is obviously pre-teen. But what I loved about them was the sense of adventure and curiosity and challenges and mysteries to be solved. And I think they really fed my childlike curiosity. that I feel that I lost for a while in my 20s and 30s. One of my favourite songs is The Logical Song by Supertramp, which talks about that loss of the childhood curiosity when we get taught how to be cynical and logical. And I feel like the older I get, the more I reconnect with that childlike curiosity that I had, and the more fascinated I become by what is reality? How does this world actually work? Who am I? And what is everything else? And what am I not seeing? And, you know, just all these mysteries of the universe. So it was very, I feel like it sort of cultivated a certain mindset, I suppose, and an appreciation of mysteries. Of course, in those books, the mysteries always got solved. There was always a lovely, as happens in fiction, tying up of the quest, you know, with a nice bow on the top. And that's emotional satisfaction that comes from a tidy conclusion. And I suspect that the tidy conclusions wait for us on the other side of our passageway out of this world, that I very much doubt that I will get to solve the mysteries of the universe in this lifetime. But I can still dream.
That's interesting. I grew up on Enid Blyton as well, so I have a lot of sympathy with that in the many, many years before I read D.H. Lawrence. And the thing that I remember most about my favourite Enid Blyton book, and I can't remember which one it was, is that they went to fairyland and they were given daffodil biscuits. Daffodil biscuits. I thought that just stayed with me. That's just such a magical thing, because daffodils can't be biscuits. You can't cook with daffodils, but they were daffodil biscuits. And that's what she did so beautifully, that kind of subversion, you know, of the expected and the creation of the unexpected, that just really, she was very, very good at that. Just presenting something that was really, really unusual that just, yeah, sticks with you. So yeah, I can relate to that.
Oh, thank you for the gift of the daffodil biscuits. I do not remember those, but it has been a little while since I read Enid Blyton. I'm going to have to Google daffodil biscuits now. Although I suspect that is going to be one of the unsolvable mysteries. What is a daffodil biscuit? We may never know.
I think we're not supposed to.
And there we go. Sharon, thank you so much. This conversation's been an absolute delight, and I do hope that one day in the not too distant future, I'll have the opportunity to come and see you in Wales and meet all of your menagerie and see your magical part of this enchanted earth.
That would be lovely indeed. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a great conversation too. Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I really appreciate how Sharon emphasises the importance of our own place. Not trying to save the planet as an abstract concept, but really cherishing the land beneath our own feet and the birds and animals that we encounter in our everyday lives. This very real reality of our here and now. And also this idea of touching the natural world and allowing it to touch us, feeling the rain on our face or the wind in our hair. And trust me, if you can grow to love and appreciate the weather in the north of Scotland or the west of Ireland, you really can love it anywhere.